This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. An escalation fears grow on the border between Israel and Lebanon. Many in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, say the country's economy cannot afford a new war. Reuters correspondent Trevor Quarrel.
The hostilities between Hezbollah and the Israeli military have taken a particularly hard toll on bus drivers, says Ali Ayub.
The whole country is stopped. The situation in the whole country is bad. Nothing is working in the country.
Lebanon had already been hollowed out by a five-year economic crisis, resulting in lost jobs and less need for daily commutes. Hezbollah and Israel have been trading rocket fire for nearly 10 months in parallel with the war in Gaza, with exchanges mostly limited to the border area. But the effects have been felt nationwide.
A huge Russian missile and drone salvo launched at Ukraine on Monday targeted energy facilities nationwide and left several people dead. More from Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino.
Thousands of residents took shelter underground as sirens blared through Kyiv overnight. I would like to see a response to Moscow so that they will feel what we feel, says this woman. Ukrainian officials say Russia launched more than 200 missiles and drones in the attack. And neighboring NATO member Poland reported a drone had probably entered its airspace during the bombardment. Kyiv said the attack targeted power or other critical infrastructure in at least 10 regions.
The Taliban is rejecting concerns and criticism raised by the United Nations over new vice and virtue laws that include a ban on women's voices and bare faces in public. On Sunday, the head of the UN mission in Afghanistan said the law showed a distressing vision for the country's future. This is VOA News. 13 U.S. service members were killed 3 years ago on Monday during a suicide bombing as U.S. troops were withdrawing from Afghanistan. The attack at the Kabul airport also left 18 U.S. service members critically injured and killed 170 Afghan civilians. VOA's Jenny Dulett.
Marking the third anniversary of the bombing, families of the fallen are pressing the Biden administration for accountability for those responsible for the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning almost two decades. President Joe Biden and his administration defended his decision to bring all troops home in 2021, saying they had long achieved the mission of diminishing Al-Qaeda and preventing Afghanistan from ever being a terrorist haven. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Simi Valley, California.
The toll from devastating floods caused by relentless monsoon rain and overflowing rivers in Bangladesh has now risen to 23, with about 1.24 million families stranded across 11 districts, according to officials Monday. As floodwaters recede slowly, many of the 5.7 million affected remain isolated and in urgent need of food, clean water, medicine, and dry clothes. Above all, in the remote areas where blocked roads have hindered rescue and relief efforts. Bangladesh Meteorological Department said that flood conditions could persist if the monsoon rains continued as water levels were receding very slowly. Canada announced Monday it is launching a 100% tariff on imports of Chinese-made electric vehicles, matching U.S. tariffs imposed over what Western governments say are China's subsidies that give its industry an unfair advantage. The announcement came after encouragements by U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan during a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Cabinet Minister Sunday. Sullivan is making his first visit to Beijing Tuesday. The Philippine Coast Guard says that China deployed an excessive force of 40 ships that blocked two Philippine vessels from delivering food and other supplies to Manila's largest Coast Guard ship in a disputed shoal. Countries blamed each other for the confrontation Monday at Sabina Shoal and the latest flare-up of their territorial disputes in the South China Sea. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A U.S.-Africa military conference will discuss the role of legal advisors in troop deployments.
When militaries deploy outside of their borders, we want them to follow and adhere to the rule of law. In the end, we want armies that the people run to, not run from.
The DRC may not receive its first delivery of mpox vaccine this week as the virus continues to impact camps for internally displaced persons. Kenyan lawmakers debate a measure that would restrict protests. Nigerian Customs Authority unveil modalities for massive food importation. Guineans debate a clause in their draft constitution calling for amnesty. The UN Secretary General discusses the humanitarian crisis caused by Sudan's continuing conflict.
The Secretary General and the General discussed the movements of humanitarian aid through Adre Crossing and agreed to facilitate the movement of humanitarian supplies to enter the country.
And analysts say Asian American voters differ in their cultures and political views. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. More than 30 African countries are being represented at the Military Law Conference that begins in Lusaka, Zambia on Tuesday. Participants will discuss the role of legal advisors in the deployment of troops as conflicts threaten stability across Africa. From Haburuni, Kundisi Dube reports.
The four-day African Military Law Forum is co-hosted by the Zambian Defense Force, the U.S. Africa Command or AFRICOM, U.S. Army Europe and Africa, as well as the North Carolina National Guard. Participants, who include military leaders and magistrates, will focus on legal advisors and their role in the deployment of troops to missions. AFRICOM's Deputy Legal Counsel, retired Colonel Max Maxwell, says it is critical to ensure the rule of law is followed when troops are deployed.
When militaries deploy outside of their borders to sometimes very remote places, we want them to follow and adhere to the rule of law. When I say rule of law, what I mean is soldiers are held accountable, commanders have legal advisors, and soldiers are inculcated in professionalism. In the end, we want armies that the people run to, not run from.
Maxwell says promoting professional conduct is crucial for the successful execution of the troops' mission.
When an army is held accountable and they are professional and the commanders have legal advisors, then the result, the end state, is that the army is more likely to execute a mission successfully, and it helps mitigate negative results. This standard of conduct promotes partnership and helps focus militaries on the rule of law, specifically professionalism, which is critical. And it is especially true in the face of increased challenges and more complex conflicts.
Brigadier General Dan Kuwali from Malawi says the Zambia meeting will also discuss ways to help soldiers avoid human rights violations during deployments. Malawi has deployed hundreds of soldiers in the conflict-torn Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as part of the Southern African Development Community mission.
We are here to build capacity as legal advisors in order to help our troops to avoid violations, but also to be able to ensure accountability for violations.
The 7th Military Law Forum is held at a time when the United States is bolstering military and security ties with African partners. Eswatini's legal counsel, Captain Poshia Magongo, says it is imperative to involve legal advisors during deployments.
Legal advisors have a very critical or very important role to play in terms of advising. They are more in a strategic position when it comes to decision makers, when it comes to commanders, be it political, be it military policies that they have to decide on.
Africa is battling increased instability, particularly in the Sahel region, where a jihad insurgency has ramped up attacks. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Haburoni, Botswana.
It appears that the Democratic Republic of Congo may not receive its first delivery of mpox vaccine this week. Reuters quotes the head of the country's response team as saying there are still several steps to follow. This as the country's army on Monday accused rebels of launching new attacks near the border with Uganda. Reporter Al Katanti Sabiti in the DRC Goma tells me that the virus is prevalent mostly in the camps for internally displaced persons.
12 provinces of DRC are affected by the outbreak of mpox, and we must know that the situation is horrible since dozens of cases are registered every day. As the country is so big and many places are not reachable, some cases are no longer registered because of the place they are located.
What has been the medical response so far? First, by the Congolese health authorities, and second, by the World Health Organization, WHO.
In the east part of the DRC, especially in the province of North Kivu, the most affected people are IDPs in their camps where there is no water for sanitation. And this is one of the problems which people are facing in the city of Goma, because the outbreak is affected people who have not any mechanism to protect themselves against this disease. While waiting for a vaccination program, Congolese health authorities are proposing to affected people an asymptomatic treatment, because, you know, mpox is not new in DRC. This is the second decade in which some provinces of DRC, such as Chopo, Sankuru, Ekwata, Manyema, have mpox outbreak. It's new in the eastern Congo, but not in the central Congo. So the treatment is ongoing, and some people are recovered, but everybody here in the DRC are waiting for the vaccination, which can block the chain of transmission.
What is the impact of the conflict in eastern Congo on the efforts to control the epidemic?
At this moment, the conflict has not yet impacted the control of this disease, because almost all cases in North Kivu are in a zone under government control. But what I fear is if some cases or lot of cases will now start being recorded in the zone under rebel control, and as roads are not open, it will be a big problem to humanitarian and to health worker to help or to treat these people affected in the rebel area. But for now, as all cases are in the zone under the government area, all affected people, such as IDP or locals of Goma, are getting medical care.
That was reporter Jafar Akatanti speaking with us from Goma, the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke over the weekend with General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the president of the Transitional Council of Sudan. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric says they discussed the humanitarian crisis caused by Sudan's continuing conflict.
The Secretary General and the General discussed the movements of humanitarian aid through Adre Crossing and agreed to facilitate the movement of humanitarian supplies to enter the country. It was also agreed to put in place a simplified system for the expedited processing and delivery of humanitarian aid. I can tell you that on Sunday, a convoy from the World Food Program's trucks crossed from Chad to Sudan via the Adre border crossing, carrying some 205 metric tons of food assistance. That will be for about 17,000 people. That's the second WFP convoy to cross through this crossing. Recently, WFP said the food assistance will be delivered to communities across Darfur, and distributions will start as soon as the trucks arrive. Additional trucks of WFP food assistance are being loaded in Chad to cross into Darfur as soon as possible. WFP has enough food for 500,000 people ready to transport to Sudan through the Adre crossing. The Rome-based agency underscores that humanitarian assistance, such as food and nutrition supplies, shelter and health items, must move quickly and at scale through all border crossings and humanitarian corridors into the hands of communities facing catastrophic levels of hunger. On the other side of Sudan, our humanitarian colleagues tell us that the Arbaat Dam, which is about 38 kilometers northwest of Port Sudan on the Red Sea state suffered extensive damage due to heavy rains yesterday. Preliminary reports indicate the breach caused extensive damage in 20 villages downstream from the dam. Our humanitarian partners and local authorities are assessing the affected areas and will have additional clarity on the extent of the damage in the coming days. The Arbaat Dam is a crucial facility in Port Sudan, serving as a primary source of fresh water for the city. The reported damage is expected to have a substantial impact on water supplies to Port Sudan, worsening the humanitarian situation.
That was the UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric speaking on the conflict in Sudan. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 27th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Kenya, lawmakers are debating a measure that will impose restrictions on protests. The move follows the recent youth-led demonstrations that turned violent and forced the government to withdraw the finance bill. The proposed anti-protest legislation will impose harsh penalties, including jail terms, for those who break the law during protests. Robert Mwangi, a Gen Z protester, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the proposed measure will not work.
It's quite a shame that parliamentarians are so coward and so afraid of Gen Z and the protests that has been happening in the country, that they are considering going to the parliament and making it a law and banning the power that is enshrined in the constitution for citizens to assemble and to protest and voice every time they have something to say. It's quite a shame that parliamentarians are saying that's the only way. That is actually destroying democracy.
The bill being considered will require organizers of protests to give the police at least 3 days to consider and provide the needed protection and to ensure that the protests are safe and peaceful. What is your take?
What we've experienced during the recent protests for Gen Z, we've seen that they've been very peaceful. And actually, safety has been infringed by the police. The police are the ones who have been beating innocent protesters, killing innocent protesters, shooting journalists, kidnapping young people. So I don't understand how the parliament are seeing that, like, the protesters are the bad people. I think the police are the bad people, and if there is a law that should be amended, it's the one that gives police this power to be this brutal to innocent people.
The Interior Minister, Kithuri Kindiki, during his parliamentary committee vetting, said he has drafted a public order act that, among other things, confines protests and demonstrations to designated areas to ensure, some argue, that the protest is contained.
I think we can both agree that that's a double speak, that's a double talk, because the people who infiltrated these protests and made it become violent, the people who are looting and burning down buildings in Kenya, they were sponsored by these politicians. So I don't understand how they can say that they are going to designate specific places for protesters to go. How can you dictate? If at all we want to go to the streets of Nairobi, we will go to the streets of Nairobi, because that's where our voices can be heard. So I don't understand how they are saying that they are going to designate specific places, make laws that you are supposed to give notice. You are not supposed to give notice to police if you want to protest. You're only supposed to go to the streets and protest peacefully. That's the only thing that is in our constitutions. And I need to comment and put this on record that we have a very beautiful constitution, and everything that Gen Z has been fighting for is for this constitution that is very nice to be implemented.
Robert Mwangi is a Kenya Gen Z protester. He spoke from Nairobi with viewers Peter Clotte. As Guinea's draft constitution awaits a referendum date, it is already generating public debate because of a clause calling for
general amnesty for members of the military junta. There is also a movement by some Guineans to petition junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya to run for president. Fayyami Limuno is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party. He tells me that a general amnesty will be like a blank check to commit crimes without accountability.
The latest is that we've been seeing civil society and political actors debating about their project of the new constitution. There are many things that people are asking to be changed, and some other things that people are asking to be added to the new constitution. So the debate is going on. And based on the plan that was presented to the people of Guinea since the beginning of the year 2024, we are expecting that referendum to be held this year of 24 by November or December.
Is it true that there's a concern that people think that the Constitution as written encourages or asks for amnesty for members of the military junta?
Yeah, there is a provision in the new Constitution saying that the amnesty law will be rolling and adopted during this period of the transition. So many people have been criticizing that because it's like signing a blank check to authorities to kill whoever they want, and they're going to get away from it. You know, the things that many people have been criticizing is that based on the law, the charter that is governing actually the transitional period, the member of CNRD and the government and also the CNT, which is the legislative body of the transition, no one of them was supposed to run for any office by the end of this transition. But based on what we have seen in the new constitution to be in writing, nobody is going to be prevented from running except those who will be under 35, like for the presidency, and over 80 years old.
How true is it that there are some Guineans who might be encouraging the military leader Doumbouya to run for, say, the presidency?
We have been seeing some movement of young people, unemployed, who are trying to find something to rely on, organizing a kind of support for President Doumbouya, or encouraging President Doumbouya to run for the presidency at the end of this transition. Even, I think this Saturday, there is a communique inviting people to Kaloum Hotel in the spirit of the transition to get together and propose something to the junta.
Fayyami Limuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. Nigerian authorities have rolled out modalities for massive food importation to reduce food prices amid the country's worst hunger crisis and economic decline in decades. Chief Superintendent of Customs spokesperson for the Nigerian Customs Service, Abdullahi Maiwada, tells viewers Chinedu 04 that only approved grains will be allowed into the country.
Foodstuffs that are expected to come into Nigeria are 6 line items. We have number one, husk brown rice, which used to be has a 30% duty and levy. Now it will be 0%. That is those companies that will be approved to bring in. We have the grain sorghum, we have the millet, we have maize, we have wheat, and we have beans. Those items, their HS code, what we call harmonized system coding, are being well stated in the statement we issued under the ECOWAS Common Tariff Several Times.
Now, when you say zero tariff, it means that importers don't pay any duties on it. How do you monitor
that zero tariff is passed on to the consumers as a lower price for some of these products. There's this fear that when it comes in, people will arbitrarily set up their own prices, defeating the very purpose of this policy.
Stated earlier, the major aim of this policy is to mitigate the high cost of food items in Nigeria market and those essential commodities I have mentioned earlier. However, if you look at our release, we mentioned a particular area where we talk about, one, the Federal Ministry of Finance will periodically provide Nigeria Customs Service with the list of imports and the approved quotas to facilitate the importation of these basic items. That is very important. Now, another issue is now companies must keep comprehensive records of any related activities which the government can request for compliance. So which means their book of accounts will also be investigated, will also be verified by government. And if any company fails to meet its obligation, definitely there will be sanctions. And the sanctions were clearly stated, which means they will lose the waivers issued to them and they are going to pay the applicable VAT and levies and import duties that were exempted earlier. So which means there is a strict penalty for whoever tried to breach the procedures laid down by the government.
Abdullahi Mawada is the chief superintendent and the spokesperson of the Nigerian Customs Service. He spoke with VOH Gina Duofor from Lagos. Since 2020, Asian Americans have been the fastest growing group of eligible voters in the U.S. According to Pew Research Center, in 2022, California had the most eligible Asian American voters in the U.S., followed by New York and Texas. From Houston, Texas, Elizabeth Lee has more on the potential and the challenge of the Asian American vote.
For flavors from Asia, Houston, Texas is a one-stop shop. The foods found here reflect the melting pot of Asian cultures living in the counties that make up the greater Houston region. One of them is suburban Fort Bend County, where Asians make up more than 21% of the population. It's also where Chinese American immigrant J.J. Clements lives.
I think for either party, they really cannot afford to ignore the Asian community.
Asian Americans are among the fastest growing ethnic groups in the U.S., according to census data. Voter turnout among this group has also seen record increases in the past two presidential elections.
I was scared. People didn't feel
the Democratic nominee for president, Kamala Harris, has taken notice and recently released two ads targeting Asians. More Asian Americans call themselves Democrat than Republican. One reason? More than half of Asian American voters are immigrants. Korean American Becky Kim is a first-time voter.
I think Trump's policies hurt minorities a lot.
Richard Murray is senior research fellow at the University of Houston.
A lot of his policies not only took aim at illegal immigrants from Mexico or South America, but also restricted legal immigration.
Still, a 2024 survey of Asian American voters found that 22% identify as Republicans. That includes Chinese American Daniel Wong.
Less government is what Asians want. More freedom and less tax.
The survey also found 31% of Asian American voters identify as independents. But 42% of Asian American voters surveyed say they have not been contacted by political candidates or a political party. Daniel Wong, who had served in local elected office, says Asian American voters are partly responsible.
We are not organized. We don't understand the American political system. And that's why we don't know how we're going to energize, put our energy together to suit for whatever common goal, which we don't have.
The projected 15 million Asian Americans eligible to vote have roots in different countries. Unifying Asian voters has been difficult. Getting Asians to donate to campaigns has also been a challenge, something Wong saw up close while running for a city council seat.
Asian, they are not used to donate to the political means. They don't understand how it works.
Clements had also run for local office.
Asian society, I don't think they, like a Christian community, they have a habit to give. So you have to educate them and you need to outreached them.
During the last presidential election, close to 60% of Asian Americans voted. Political activists say forming relationships with new Asian American citizens and educating them about the political process will mobilize them to get involved. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
And that's it for this Tuesday, August 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you have an amazing Tuesday.